It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Miss America, Grace Stanky, representing Miss Wisconsin, of course, earning the title and crown last month. That crowning moment courtesy of the Miss America organization. Grace is a nuclear engineering major at UW-Madison from Wausau. Call in about what you want to ask Miss America, the pageant tradition, the social impact work that candidates take on. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Grace, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. How are you doing today?
I am well. So let's talk about that moment. What was going through your mind when you felt that crown placed on your head 3 weeks ago?
Well, absolutely thankfulness, but in all reality, it was also absolute chaos. You know, that's a moment that, in the same way an athlete envisions the gold medal, that's sort of what it was for me. It's that envisioning and that dream coming to life. But at this point in time, I've now earned almost $70,000 in scholarships to go towards my education, thanks to the Miss America organization. The Miss America organization awards $5 million in scholarships a year to women all across the country. And that really speaks to the character of what this organization represents and what being Miss America is all about.
Had you visualized that moment happening to you in the days beforehand? Had you prepared yourself? I mean, you were like, in looking at that moment, you were exchanging a lot of words with Miss New York with, you know, in those final seconds. Can you share what you were expressing there?
Yes. So one of the best things about going to Miss America is meeting those other 50 incredible women. We have a woman from each state and the District of Columbia compete for the job of Miss America. And every single one of those women on those stages were able to do the job of Miss America. They were incredible. We had trauma surgeons, we had teachers, we had lawyers, attorneys, performing arts specialists, future of all of those things, and so many more incredible women. And when I was standing up there with Taryn, who was Miss New York, she was the first runner up. We were really just sharing kind words with each other. I was telling her how I envisioned her year as Miss America, because it truly is about supporting each other as women and uplifting each other as we continue our lives. You know, only one woman walks away as Miss America, but that doesn't change the fact that we're able to go on and do great things in this world.
We're talking about the goals and the impact of Grace Stanky, Miss America, UW-Madison Nuclear Engineering Senior. We'll get more into that in a moment. You can join in along the way about Miss America, 800-642-1234. So, Grace, before winning the pageant, you won the Talent Scholarship with a classical violin performance, and we're going to listen here to an excerpt. Oh, my goodness. I think we're having some audio problems. So we're going to stop that excerpt because it was amazing as I listened to it. So can you tell us about the piece you performed?
Yes. So I played Storm by Vivaldi, which is also in the classical world more commonly known as the third movement of Summer from the Four Seasons that Antonio Vivaldi wrote. One thing about the Miss America competition is the talent portion. We are limited to 90 seconds. So I condensed that piece down and took the fun, exciting parts out of it, because the Miss America competition is all about the entertainment aspect when it comes to talent. And, you know, anybody can get up there and do anything. We've had Miss Americas that do science experiments. We have monologues. We have also the traditional singing, dancing, and musical instruments. But talent is really a different word for can you entertain an audience in some way, which is just awesome, because I was able to go through and use this as an outlet to explore my violin in a more creative manner. I actually didn't, it was classical, but the accompaniment, if you listen, is not classical at all. It's got drums, it's got a little bit of a different beat to it. So I wanted to have a blend of a classical instrument and a classical piece, but with a modern twist.
And I noticed you're moving a lot around the stage as you play your violin. And so how did you incorporate that movement, that choreography into, you know, a difficult violin piece?
A lot of it comes back to that entertainment aspect. For me, I just got the playing to be just pure muscle memory. And after that, it's more about going out on stage and just having fun for me. And that was something I did, and walking around, making eye contact with people, you know, having fun with the performance and making it entertaining is why that moving around is happening. And it's something that's fun to it. I think it adds a lot to the performance.
And it is, I think you mentioned 90 seconds of a piece of a performance. So, you know, I can understand how you would have that in muscle memory, and then the rest you can really engage with the things around you.
Yes, exactly.
How has playing the violin helped you see your education and see problems in new ways? What has it opened up for you?
So this is one thing I talk a lot about as a nuclear engineer, actually, and an engineering student. My violin has been such a huge part of my life, one, in a way for me to cope with my emotions, but also in a way for me to look at engineering problems with a different perspective. I always get frustrated when people say, okay, are you right-brained or left-brained? But I fully believe people can be both. And I think that having the ability to be an engineer and a musician makes me, one, a better musician, but also too a better engineer, because I'm able to look at things with a little bit of a different perspective than somebody who's really set on that one track mind. But it's something that I'm so thankful for, and I think it's good to focus in on one or the other if that's what somebody wants. But for me, I personally support doing both of it, doing as much as I can in order to diversify my background and diversify my experience. I'm a competitive water skier. I love hiking. I love, you know, my violin and spending time with my family, on top of nuclear engineering. And I think all of those things are what gives me a good background to be an engineer.
We're going to talk more about that competitive water skiing because I'm really interested. I mean, but you know,
Yeah.
how do you balance all of those interests? Where do you find the time, and how do you prioritize?
Well, prioritize, you know, school, work, that always is going to come first, no matter what. But when it comes down to it, it's really all of those things are things I enjoy. And each of them have their own sort of aspect in my life where, you know, my violin was, I've been playing for 12 years, and it was a big part of my life when my dad went through cancer, not once, but twice. It was a way for me to sort of help with the emotions that I was feeling as a 13-year-old that was watching my dad, you know, go from a 6'6" teddy bear to basically a bag of skin and bones, which is always a terrifying experience, but it's something that my violin really helps me through that. And having those ways of just different outlets for me to portray myself and be myself was so important for me. And when it comes to time management, you know, lists, that's where being an engineer comes in handy, because I am definitely, I've got Excel spreadsheets, I've got lists, I've got it all.
Your father influenced your decision to follow the path of nuclear engineering. What was that impression he made on you? Can you tell us a bit about that story?
Yeah, so when I was 16 years old, I knew I wanted to go into engineering. My dad was a civil engineer, so I grew up seeing construction sites and seeing bridges put up and taken down and things like that. So I toured a bunch of colleges, and nuclear engineering just sounded really cool, right? That's honestly what it started out as. And when it came down to actually making a decision, I had engineering narrowed down to either aerospace or nuclear. And I was talking to my dad about it, just like, all right, what do you think? And he goes, well, don't go into nuclear. There's no future there. There's no career there. And the 16-year-old me went, all right, dad, watch me. And I ended up going into it. And now he is a very big supporter of nuclear energy. I've fallen in love with the field and gotten into the field for other reasons now, both in terms of like career and the absolute fun I have with it. I'm a type of person that loves a challenge and doing something different every day. And the nuclear engineering field is really sort of a melting pot of all different types of engineering. We have to know a little bit of electrical. We have to know a little bit of mechanical. We have to know a little bit of chemical things and just a little bit of everything in order to make a nuclear power plant operate. But now my dad, like I said, is a huge supporter of nuclear energy, and he's always been supportive of me and my journey, and I'm incredibly thankful for that.
And he was there with you, I understand, at the Miss America competition. That must
Yes.
have meant the world to you.
Yes, it did. I had a lot of my family out there, actually. I was shocked because Miss America was right before December, so I was like, okay, with the holidays, like I'm not expecting anyone to really make it out if they can't make it. But they actually had our parents sitting on stage during finals night for the top
Oh,
11.
wow.
And that was, for me, I'm the type of person that's always been like, I'm fiercely independent from my parents, right? But I definitely seeing them the first time on stage, it brought a tear to my eye. And it's really about the volunteers and the parents and the people behind the scenes that help make this organization go around and help create these great women that are going on to do great things in the future. And I am so thankful for their support and for the volunteer support that were also out there at the Miss America competition. They might not have been sitting on stage, but going to Miss America isn't just a one person thing. It's a team of people behind me that helped me get there, and I cannot thank those people enough.
Miss America Grace Stanky of Wisconsin receiving the crown and title at the Miss America competition held last month in Connecticut. Join in with your questions for Grace, your reflections on these competitions and the Miss America organization, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin's own Grace Stanky of Wausau was crowned Miss America last month. The organization said it marked 50 years since the first Miss Wisconsin won Miss America. Call in with your questions about the pageant system, how it is to compete, your personal stories. They're welcome as well. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. And Miss America Grace Stanky stays with us. Grace, it was interesting how the news about nuclear fusion and how they achieved ignition, that kind of coincided with the whole pageant. Can you tell us a little bit more about nuclear power and what people should understand about nuclear energy?
Yes, so nuclear fusion, that discovery was a fantastic discovery in the world of research and moving towards that source of energy. But we already have nuclear power that is energizing about 20% of America through our current nuclear power plants, which is powered by fission, which there's two separate nuclear reactions. Fission is the breaking apart of atoms. Fusion is the opposite. It's building up. So I like to remember them with fusion has a U, so up, right? But nuclear power is already powering 20% of America with safe, effective, and reliable energy. And it's zero carbon throughout all of that as well. And one of the perks about nuclear energy being zero carbon is it actually doesn't rely on its outside environment in any way. And I firmly believe that that's why it should be one of our primary energy sources as we continue the conversion to zero carbon energy, because it doesn't use a lot of land. So that way, as our population continues to grow, we can continue using that land for farming and agricultural purposes. And we can use that clean, zero carbon energy coming from nuclear energy to power our cities and power our major areas.
A major environmental concern, though, related to nuclear power is the creation of radioactive waste and the used up reactor fuel. Like, what is safe and ethical to have this waste product, decay, and where should it be stored? How do you think about those concerns?
Each individual throughout their entire lifetime would only produce as much. I guess we can call it waste for now. I'll get into that in a second here. But each individual throughout their lifetime creates only one soda can's worth of waste, right? And that's such a small amount in comparison to the tons of emissions that coal and fossil fuel and natural gas plants are creating. But when it comes down to it, nuclear waste really isn't waste. When we pull it out of the plant, there still is at least 80% of that energy in that fuel still there. But because of public policy, we're not able to recycle, we're not able to reuse that waste for any other purposes. So it's not a science or a technology issue. We know how we could manage that waste and continue to reuse it in other beneficial ways, ranging from medicinal purposes to refueling and putting it right back into those nuclear power plants. But overall, I think one of the biggest misconceptions is that nuclear waste is, you know, truly dangerous or a lot of it, when in reality, right now here in Wisconsin, we've got one nuclear power plant that's been operating for 40 years. All of the waste that it's produced in 40 years can fit within an Olympic-sized swimming pool, and it doesn't fill up that swimming pool. So it's such a small amount of waste in comparison to every other form of energy, and that is truly remarkable.
Nuclear fusion is sometimes labeled the holy grail of clean energy. Why is it such a big deal?
So fusion is the building up of atoms, which I mentioned earlier. So combining two atoms to create a new atom, and not necessarily new, but a bigger atom and some extra form of energy along with it. And one of the main reasons why this is seen as the holy grail of energy production is because it can be fueled by water, which we all know is a source we have a lot of here on Earth. And that's something that when it comes to the output, there is very little radiation output or anything along those lines. However, there's a lot of difficulties that the scientific community still has to overcome, because fusion is, we're basically trying to create a sun here on planet Earth is what it is, because fusion is what's going on in the sun. And we're trying to do that on a smaller scale here on the planet. So that leads to a lot of confinement and containment issues and things like that. But there is some tremendous strides being made in the fusion community, and I fully support it. I am so excited to continue to see where that field goes, as I used to work in a fusion lab, and that's something that was always exciting to be a part of.
Grace Stanky with us, Miss America, UW-Madison Nuclear Engineering Senior. You can join in along the way at 800-642-1234. Emily's with us from Milwaukee with a question. Hi, Emily. Go ahead.
Oh, good morning. Hi, Grace. I remember back when I was a little girl. I think I'm much older than you are. Like, the pageants seemed like they had a swimsuit competition. I think Miss America eliminated it a few years ago, but I'm just curious. I assume this wasn't your first pageant, and if you've observed any other sort of positive changes in that, how pageants are conducted, and whether you had participated in different style pageants before, or if in your experience they've always been kind of more focused on education and more positive things.
Thank you, Emily. Grace, go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, Emily. First of all, I'm so excited to talk with you. So the Miss America organization removed the swimsuit competition about 5 years ago now. So the Miss America organization is undergoing some tremendous changes. We don't judge on outward beauty anymore. So we actually don't even call ourselves a beauty pageant at this point. We're a scholarship competition, because it comes back to the idea that the Miss America organization, we award $5 million in scholarships a year to women across the country. And that's changing lives. It's not about how you can walk in a swimsuit. It's about what ideas can you present? Can you sit in a boardroom and guide the conversation? And that's something that's very important to me. You know, I competed in the outstanding teen portion of this organization. So for those of you that don't know, Miss America is women ages 18 to 26. And there's an outstanding teen division for women ages 13 to 18. And I participated in that. And at that time, the Miss level still had swimsuits. Outstanding teen does what's called fitness and lifestyle. So there's no swimsuit for teens. But it's something that I saw the Miss competition at the time, and I wouldn't have come back if I didn't support these changes and love these changes, which I truly do. It's exciting to see how this organization is evolving, and the caliber of women that are involved are career-driven, ambitious. I have no doubt that we have future presidents of the United States that are participating in our competition.
Last year, Miss America's winner said she planned to use the platform to promote inclusion and open-mindedness. Mm-hmm. How could the organization become a more welcoming competition to people of diverse backgrounds and diverse views?
We already have an incredible diverse group of women. You know, looking at the 51 women that were on that stage that night, I mentioned this earlier, we had trauma surgeons, we had teachers, we had nurses, we had people from all different types of backgrounds. Our judging panel this year was incredibly diverse. It was recognized by Vogue magazine, and that's something that's truly remarkable. We're modernizing with times and continuing to promote that.
What steps could the organization take now, do you think, to make the competition relevant long into the future? Where does it go next?
I think right now we're seeing those changes happen. I think there's a big difference in what the women are in the Miss America organization in comparison to any other organization that we might be compared to. We're not afraid to speak out and speak not only on a national level, but on a global level. We're promoting changes that are important and relevant in society. And America is a global leader. I don't see why Miss America shouldn't be. And I'm excited to go into my year to promote clean energy for a cleaner future and speak, like I said, not only on a national but an international level about nuclear power across the globe.
Grace, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it, Kate.
Miss Wisconsin Grace Stanky is a nuclear engineering student and the recently crowned Miss America 2023. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a resilient group of dancers.
Scene. With their matching outfits and dance routines, they bring joy and inspiration to people, even after an unthinkable tragedy. Christina Leffring brings us their story.
The day of Muskego's Christmas parade has been cold, rainy, and pretty gloomy. Yet Main Street in this small city in Waukesha County is lined with grandparents, parents, and of course kids, waiting for the parade. Especially the Milwaukee Dancing Grannies. For almost 40 years, the troupe of grandmothers dancing and waving pom-poms in formation have been a highlight of holiday parades across eastern Wisconsin. But last year, three members and one member's husband were killed when Daryl Brooks drove his vehicle through the Waukesha Christmas Parade. The Grannies have always been a fan favorite, but in light of last year's tragedy, crowds have celebrated their return with standing ovations.
I think everybody on the entire street was standing and clapping. So it was a bit emotional, and it was really wonderful to see.
It actually makes me cry every time I see them, just with everything that happened. And they're so cute, and it just breaks my heart still. And it brings me joy to see them at all the parades.
They're fantastic. We love them every time. I want to be a dancing granny someday.
It's really a lot harder than it looks.
That's Doreen Lopez, who joined just last January.
Well, it's not for the faint of heart. It's a lot of work. It's a big commitment.
Dancing grannies rehearse at least once a week. Each member is expected to perform in at least two-thirds of the parades the group is scheduled for, which in the winter could mean two or three parades in one weekend.
You think, you know, you're going to the practices, it's time-consuming, it's hard, and then you do a parade and you think, worth it.
That's Janet Pauly, another new member. Pauly and Lopez were two of several new grannies who joined in January. After the Waukesha attack, the group decided to hold auditions to strengthen their membership.
I knew that when I started, you realize how time-consuming it is, and I thought, I'll try it a year, and I think we're all in it for the long haul.
A few veteran grannies also danced in Muskego. Janice Kramer has been a granny for 19 years. This past year was particularly hard for her. She knew two of the women killed in Waukesha personally, and had a series of deaths in her family shortly after. including her husband. But she's still dancing.
So this kind of helps me get through that. It gives me, you know, I can make it. I can make it. I'm not going to be sitting home in a fetal position somewhere in a corner.
One silver lining is more people have learned about the group, like Kramer's neighbor, who saw her leave the house in the granny's royal blue winter uniform, trimmed with white fur and a fur hat.
He rolled the window down. He said, "Are you really a dancing granny?" I said, "Yes, I am. You know, I don't dress like this for nothing."
She's struggling to keep up physically, but she's still motivated by the camaraderie.
All the girls were so great, just like these new ones are, just fantastic women. I was thinking I might have to retire because I'm getting older and stuff, but these girls are so much fun. I think I have to stick around maybe for a while longer.
Plus, there are the crowds.
Have you ever walked in a parade? Oh my God, you should do that because we're old ladies and you get wolf whistles out there. I mean, I'm 75. How many more years am I going to have somebody doing a wolf whistle to us, you know? That's incentive enough.
The group says they've gotten a lot of messages from people who want to join and who can blame them. The group will announce plans for expanding and auditions after their members take a well-deserved break to rest and recuperate.
Christina Laffering brought us that story on the Milwaukee Dancing Grannies. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to how climate change is affecting trout and what the future holds for these fish with their food, their offspring, stream habitats. We unpack new trends on Wisconsin brook trout and brown trout published recently in the journal Ecosphere. A special shout out to Richard in Two Rivers, who requested more fishing conversations during a caller-only program.
I'm concerned with all the shows I listen to, which are all good, whether it's politics or not. There's never, ever anything on fishing.
Well, call in with your questions about trout streams and what you've noticed. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Brian Maitland is a postdoctoral researcher at UW-Madison's Center for Limnology and the paper's corresponding author. Brian, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we dive into your survey data and its findings, can you give us a little primer on brook trout and brown trout and how these fish species look, their tendencies, their range, and habitat in Wisconsin?
Yeah, sure. So the native brook trout and the introduced and now naturalized brown trout, they're two cold water fish species that really rely on cold, clean, natural flowing water, natural hydrological regime for their growth, for their reproduction, for their long-term persistence. And in Wisconsin, there's an abundance of cold water streams due to plentiful groundwater resources across the region, right? In fact, there's over 13,000 miles of cold water streams, cold water trout streams across the state. And those streams, they all support naturally reproducing fisheries for brook trout and brown trout. And these fish are really highly valued. They contribute millions of dollars annually to local and regional economies, everywhere from fly shops to gas stations. Just think about the iconic Driftless region in southeast Wisconsin that brings in people from all over the world for angling opportunities. And they're also of high cultural importance to Native American tribes and anglers alike. And as you just mentioned, there's also some aesthetic beauty there as well. I mean, brook trout and brown trout, they're very beautiful fish. So if you've ever been out there to catch one, you can gaze into the beautiful lines and stripes that they have, all of them. They're very pretty fish.
So, you know, the names of the fish are similar, but, you know, they aren't. Brown trout are, I understand, more closely related to Atlantic salmon. Brook trout, actually a type of char?
Yeah, you got it. So brook trout are, their species name is Salvelinus fontanellus. So they're Salvelinus species, which means they're char. So they're more closely related to lake trout. And then, just like you said, brown trout are an introduced species. They're originally from Europe, and they've been introduced all over the world. In fact, they're one of the most introduced species on the planet. from everywhere from New Zealand to South America and everywhere in between. And yeah, they are Salmo tretta, so they're mostly closely related to the Atlantic salmon. Yep.
So you looked at more than 25 years of survey data to see how Wisconsin's brook and brown trout are being affected by climate change. What have you learned?
Yeah, so, well, the problem here is that we have greenhouse gas emissions that are causing the climate to shift. And in Wisconsin, that means things are getting hotter and wetter. And so, for example, summer air temperatures have gone up by about 2 degrees since the 1950s, and we've seen about a 15% or 4.5-inch increase in average annual precipitation in the state. And these shifts means that we're getting shifts to our trout streams as well. And if these extreme events or these hot weather systems or these big storm events happen during key seasons in a trout's life, they can really hinder their ability to reproduce, to lay eggs, to hatch and grow into adulthood. And so what we did was we took use of the DNR's long-term trout monitoring program, which is a way for the DNR to really keep a finger on the pulse of these populations through time. And we were able to link that up with a lot of local climate information to see how trout populations have been responding to the shifting climate over the past 25 years or so. And there's two big findings that we came away with. And first was that overall, if you look across the state, we found that on average, after accounting for a lot of those year-to-year ups and downs that populations go through, the number of brook trout in streams has been going down, especially since about 2006, while the number of brown trout has been steadily going up. So the next thing we wanted to do was actually understand how and if some of those shifting climate conditions has contributed to those increases or declines. And we found that indeed, seasonal climate really does influence these populations, but the impact really depends on where you are, which species you are, and where you are in the state. So as a great example, one of the big findings was above normal summer temperatures appear to really hinder brook trout, but help out brown trout. And this is likely due to the fact that native brook trout, they really prefer their water temperatures a little bit cooler than brown trout. So the brown trout can actually deal with those summer water temperatures a bit better than brook trout. But then within species, even within brook trout, we saw some different effects across the state. So, for example, warmer summers were really bad for brook trout in southern Wisconsin, down here at the edge of their range, while effects in northern Wisconsin were much more muted.
Ah, okay. So a lot of variables there to kind of flush out and figure out what's going on. One thing I'm just curious about before we move on, though, is are brook trout found in Lake Superior if they like these really cold water temps? I think of Lake Superior.
Yeah, sure. There is populations all along the northern part of Michigan and Wisconsin up there in Lake Superior, and they're doing well up there. In fact, a lot of the brook trout populations are doing better than they are in some of the southern parts of the state. And again, that's because that's further away from the edge of their distribution. So up there, on average, temperatures haven't really got as warm as they have down south. So when we're thinking about temperature and brook trout, they're seeming to do a little bit better up north.
Okay, so it is temperature that is a major influence, but you've also talked about early winter thaws and these intense rain events hurting these species. What are you finding there?
Yeah, and this was one of the big ones, and this is one of the more universal effects that we found on both species, and this really relates to how much seasonal precipitation we get. So across the board, we found that heavy winter rains and heavy spring rains result in precipitous declines in natural reproduction for both species. And this is really because if we get these lots of precipitation that turns into high stream flows during these seasons, they can scour out those gravel beds where the trout eggs are incubating in the winter. And then in the spring, it can overstress those newly hatched baby fish. So if we get lots of rain coming down during these seasons, which we're increasingly getting, especially in southeast Wisconsin during these seasons, it can really be potentially bad for the long-term sustenance or persistence, I should say, of populations in some of these streams.
And that's not a predictable thing. I mean, that can be really scattered, those rain events, and whereas perhaps warming water temperatures are more of an incremental variable?
They are, but one thing that we're going to be seeing with in the future, one thing that we do have a good idea on, especially for a lot of the research coming out of the Wisconsin Initiative for Climate Change impacts, is we're going to see more extreme events occur. So there's going to be more seasons, and there's going to be more seasons in succession where we have some of these extreme events. So for example, if you have one summer that's very hot, followed by a potentially very cold fall, followed by a very wet winter and spring, that can hit a population at multiple times during their life cycle that can really put heavy stresses on those populations and potentially allow them not to reproduce the following year. And if you do that a couple of years in a row, that's where we get to those population declines and collapses.
Mm. UW-Madison postdoctoral researcher Brian Maitland studies the intersection of Midwest trout streams and climate change effects. Colin with Wisconsin Trout questions what you wonder about the resiliency, the sensitivity of these fish in the face of our warming planet. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Climate change is adding stress to river ecosystems in Wisconsin and beyond, and the brook trout and the brown trout can feel it and are reacting. We explore new research on our state's trout streams and what to expect in the future. And fishers, let's hear from you at 800-642-1234. We have UW-Madison Center for Limnology. Postdoc researcher Brian Maitland is our guide. Let's bring on a caller, Jeff in Delafield. Jeff, hi, what would you like to ask?
Yes, good morning. My comment or question is, in modern agriculture, we see an increased use of plastic drain tiles. You drive around the winter and any farm that or land that doesn't already have drain tiles seems to be adding drain tiles. So I doubt that there's much land that isn't tiled in the state anymore. So does that have an appreciable impact on flow rates and streams? And if so, why do we continue to allow that practice?
Jeff, thank you. Yes, Brian.
Yeah, thanks for the question. I have to say I'm really not the best person to respond to that. But what I can say is that anything that we can do to reduce the effects of flooding into our streams. And so, for example, when we do get those heavy downpours, anything that we can do to reduce that flooding into streams is going to not only benefit the fish communities that live there, but it'll also benefit the human communities that live on the banks of those systems, right? So things like increasing riparian habitat, that can be a huge way to buffer some of that water flowing in quickly across the surface of the landscape, just the same way that mangroves do on coastal ecosystems. When a big storm comes in, they'll buffer some of that energy. And riparian habitat, really strong riparian habitat can help do that in some of our stream ecosystems as well.
What about the impact of dams and dam removal? Does that affect these fish?
Yeah, also a great question. When we think about connectivity, one thing that we always want to do is increase connectivity on the landscape. And one thing that we can do is, the bigger problem is, I mean, dams are an issue, but the other one is stream crossings and road culverts and stuff like this. And so one thing that we can do is we can go out there and fix poorly functioning road culverts and stream crossings. And what that can do is that can really ensure that trout can access thermally suitable habitat during some periods that some of their stream gets too hot. They can move around the landscape. So improving that connectivity can go a long way to building resiliency into our populations for the long term.
Let's take another call. Jim is with us from Wausau. Jim, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I'm just wondering about like river flooding, how that affects trout streams, because I do know from experience that there's a river, Spring Brook, and flooded back in 2006, and it's never been the same.
As a trout fisher, what have you, Jim, while you're on the line here, what have you noticed? What have you observed through the years?
I used to fish that regularly when I was a kid. And, you know, all the gravel bed were destroyed, and like the pH level of the stream went haywire, and you can't even catch a brook trout out of there anymore.
Hmm. Jim, thank you for the question and the observations. What is that impact of river flooding? Can it recover afterward, years later, Brian?
Yeah, great question. So I'll first say there's definitely a lot of other local factors that go into how a particular stream in a particular part of the state will respond to these things. But on the whole, this is where one of the big takeaways from our study was the effect that the fact that some of it really depends on when some of these events happen, that it can be detrimental or positive for trout populations. So a good example is if you remember the big floods that happened back in August of 2018 in yes. Southeast Wisconsin and the mm-hmm. Driftless, that many folks will remember, those floods happen in August. They happen during the summer period. And we actually see from the data that the next couple years, there was actually big boosts in trout populations in that part of the world. And that's because if we get these floods during the summer, it can actually increase access. It can open up more habitat to fish. It can allow them to find more food. It can also allow them to find additional spawning habitat that they might not get in a very dry year. But then conversely, as I mentioned earlier, if we get these big floods coming in the winter and spring, they can scour out those gravel beds and take out some of those eggs that are incubating under the gravel, or in the spring, they can knock out those newly hatched fry. Hmm. So it really depends on when some of these things are happening and if they happen successfully over a couple years. And then the backside of that question too is, can these systems recover? Surely they can. Rivers and streams have been flooding for time immemorial. So they can, but it also depends, like I said, on a lot of other local factors that are happening in your watershed.
Brian Maitland with us, postdoc researcher, UW-Madison Center for Limnology. Let's go to Travis and Nina with a question. Travis, hi.
Hi, morning.
Morning.
Yeah, I had a question. I guess it was more of a comment. I found it curious that the brook trout population is more affected in the Southwest, considering the significantly different hydrology, being that the northern part of the state, I believe the groundwater is more of a function of shallower groundwater, which would be impacted more by the atmosphere versus the hydrology in the southwestern part of the state.
Brian, can you flesh that out with hydrology? What do you see there?
Question, and it's actually something we couldn't get directly to in our study. One thing that we are trying to develop, and there's ongoing research to get to this point, is building statewide hydrological models that can actually incorporate not only surface water flow that comes down from precipitation, but can also link that up to groundwater information and how groundwater contributes to streams. So in our study, we really had to focus on the climate effects. We had to focus on air temperature and precipitation and how those things might be affecting trout. A next level in this study, a next level in this research program is really going to try to figure out how groundwater is influencing those trends as well. So it's ongoing research, and I unfortunately don't have a good answer for you yet on that one.
We only have a few seconds left, but where do you like to fish?
I can't let that information be known, but I will say that I have had some fantastic times fishing in the Driftless region. I do love it down there, and I've also had some great times up in northern Wisconsin on some lakes and small ponds. So the great thing about this state is there's, like I said, there's over 13,000 miles of cold water trout streams, and you can go wet your line anywhere and probably have a good time.
Oh, Brian, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, Kate. Thanks again.
Brian Maitland is a postdoctoral researcher at UW-Madison Center for Limnology. We have a link, by the way, to his journal article in Ecosphere on climate conditions and Midwestern stream trout. You can find it at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.